Welcome to episode 282 of The Lab. I'm Brad Barton.
I'm Phil Barton.
This is one in a continuing series on computers, computing, and the history thereof. If you'd like to hear the other episodes, you can find them by visiting thelabwithbrad.com. Also, links.
Yay!
A whole bunch of links to vintage equipment yet again.
Mm-hmm.
Because today we are talking about magnets.
All right.
We can go all the way back to Faraday if you'd like. But let's not.
We keep doing
you're
that.
You're aware, right? Like if you got a nail and you put a magnet on it, then that nail has become, at least for a time, magnetized.
Yeah.
And the stronger the magnet you stick the nail on, the more likely it is to stay magnetized when you take it away.
Absolutely.
Or you can take a relatively weak magnet and stroke it along the length of the nail over and over again.
Heck yeah. Silk. I hear you can also do that with...
Magnetized? To stroke the needle to make it magnetized.
Yeah.
Ah, we'll have to try that sometime.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Next time we have a cork. This bottle of wine is for scientific research. It's a screw off, Brad. Oh, we need another bottle of wine for scientific research. First guy who talked about making magnetic recordings in 1888.
Ooh.
But the guy never pursued it. The idea he had in his head was too difficult and expensive. It was beyond his personal means.
Okay.
But about 10 years later, another guy, a Danish fellow, made it work.
Hey.
He used wire.
Oh.
Stainless steel wire, hair thin.
Okay.
And they keep comparing the length to the thickness of a human hair.
Yeah, yeah.
The length was something like 1.4 miles of this for like a 15-20 minute recording.
Oh, wow.
Just like any other magnetic analog recording medium, what happens is a magnet puts a magnetic field on the material. This time it's just stainless steel wire. It works. And then later, when you go by, you have sort of an inductor coil that passes through that magnetic field. And then you can amplify the signal and play it.
Oh, I'm glad you said all that, because I actually never really understood.
How any of that worked at all?
Yeah. But now I think of cassette tapes and stuff. Yeah, it all makes sense.
Now it all makes sense. And the steel wire thing, it had its heyday. Right, but the sound quality wasn't all that good. It was, however, something you could record on over and over again.
Okay, yeah.
And these spools of wire would give you a lot more time than the other tricks that were available.
Okay.
All the other tricks were mechanical. There were wax cylinders and discs that were being used as dictaphones.
Oh, okay, yeah.
Because that was as much quality as you could get, that someone could type what you said.
But you can't store them next to the fireplace.
You can't store them next to the fireplace. It's difficult to reuse the medium.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And the more you play it, the worse the sound gets. That's true of records as well.
Oh, yeah.
Like vinyl records. But they last a lot longer, a lot more plays than these wax thingies. There was even for a while... home recording kits for vinyl.
Really?
Yeah. I never saw one of those, so I guess I missed out on that entirely. I remember record players and actual records. And I remember tape recorders that were larger than me. But anyway, so this wire recording thing is happening. I actually have a link to a video. A guy explains how it works and demonstrates it. There was one spool he found with... the caption said something like 1955 New Year's Eve.
Really?
Somebody had just recorded a get-together with friends.
On wire. Okay.
Yeah, when I thought about the path it took for them there to get onto the wire, to get picked up by this retro equipment enthusiast, then put on the YouTube, and then comes out the speakers, then finally I hear it.
Thank God it was marked, because otherwise, you know, they just cut it up and start baling hay or something. Yeah.
Anyway, during World War II, towards the end there, they noticed that certain Berlin officials seemed to be able to travel much faster than they should be able to. They're giving the same speech in widely separated areas, almost overlapping.
Oh.
So they figured there had to be some nifty record and playback technology going on there somewhere. After the war, an engineer found it. They were using iron oxides, glued to a paper tape backing.
Oh, okay.
Now, that's magnetic tape.
Yeah, yeah.
Took it home. By 1948, he had a couple of patents and improvements.
Yeah.
Bing Crosby got involved. I guess he was tired of doing, like, before audio tape, this I did not know, the standard for radio broadcast was live. If you wanted music, you brought the musicians into the studio.
Holy crap. Okay, yeah.
Because all the recording technology sounded awful.
Okay, yeah.
Well, Bing Crosby didn't like having to do his show twice a night,
yeah.
You know, for East Coast, West Coast.
Mm-hmm.
So he finds out about this tape recorder and dumped about 20 grand of his own money.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, nice work if you got it. But then, you know, it ushered in the era. Now, not only are we recording, you can take the best take. And this is the era of slice and splice audio recording.
Nice.
Where you to edit, you'd sit down at the table with a razor blade and some glue and go to town.
I like how expensive him being lazy was for him.
The 20 grand. That was an investment. I'm sure he got return.
Oh, I hope so. Yeah, yeah. Holy crap.
And he had money, too. Yeah, good old Bing Crosby. Anyway, the whole thing, it lent itself to data storage. It's actually pretty easy.
Yeah.
Even before cassette tapes. And cassette tapes eventually showed up. Remember, we had this really crappy computer. Late 70s, early 80s.
Okay.
It actually used an audio cassette to hold this data.
That thing, the one we hooked up to the TV?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, okay, yeah.
Offside data storage instead of a hard drive or even a floppy disk. It was an audio cassette.
Because they were cheap. And
it was slow and painful. But using magnetic tape to store huge chunks of data, that still happens to this day.
Oh, hey.
If you've got a server farm and you want to back up everything.
The long-term storage, the archive.
Yes. So that's one form of output, but input and output. Screens and keyboards. We talk about that on Monday.
Boy.
I really enjoy finding these links.
Yeah, yeah.
Because you get all these old machinery, these YouTube videos of these old machines running.
Oh, hey.
It's fun.
Mm-hmm.
I was kind of looking up...
Kind of.
The CRT, right?
Yeah, yeah.
It wasn't computer monitor for quite some time. Not till 1964.
Okay.
Did they come up with the idea of using a CRT to show what you just typed at the computer.
Oh, okay.
And I was like, okay, so what was input and output before then?
Mm-hmm.
And I was kind of poking at this. I was actually originally looking at the history of the keyboard.
Yeah, yeah.
But that was too long.
Let's focus on monitors.
There's some links with more information available at thelabwithbrad.com.
Yeah.
Yeah, but they had all these teletype machines. We've talked about them before.
Mm-hmm.
When they're trying to make telegraphy faster.
Yeah, yeah.
And more reliable. They had all these machines. You type this, it would send the information down a wire,
mm-hmm.
or punch it into a punch card or punch tape.
Mm-hmm.
Just ka-chunk, 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 ka-chunk. And so when they were first making computers and they wanted output, they were connecting these teletype machines up to the computers.
Hey, okay. Yeah.
Now, in these machines, even after the transistor shows up, mm-hmm. which will get its own episode, in like the 1950s, 1960s, even 1970s, sci-fi computer
mm-hmm.
clicks and whirs, and all of its output comes a 4-inch wide strip of tape.
What does it mean?
The machines like that were still being designed and sold and used.
Uh-huh.
First experiments with using a keyboard for input. Let's see if I can get this right. I'm not even on my notes file, so no, I can't. The BINIAC, whenever that happened, 1948, had teletype for input and output.
Okay.
In fact, I think in 1956, they had one where you'd type at the machine that made the magnetic tape.
Mm-hmm.
And then instead of going on a reel, it would go directly into the computer.
Okay.
You're so close, guys. How about a few wires? It'll be great. Everything will be fine.
Nice.
But yeah, it wasn't until 1964. It's a collaboration between MIT, Bell Laboratories, and General Electric.
Holy crap. Okay. Everybody.
And they made a time-sharing, multi-user computer.
Okay.
And they had a system they just come up with that would show what you just typed with an electric keyboard on the CRT.
Nice. Okay.
Yeah.
It's about time.
Until 64. Before then, they were using something called the Flexo Rider. And that's when I got a couple of videos. So this is give me an idea. Like step one, turn on the motor.
Oh wow. Okay. With a name like that, yeah, it was doomed.
Flexo Rider. Not a very good segue.
Yeah.
In or out.
Yeah, I'll but, oh hey.
So oh hee, oh ha. So where are we? World War II. Let's back up to there again.
Okay.
The United States Navy asked the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, MIT, gee whiz, do you think you guys could make some sort of flight simulator for us?
Okay, yeah.
The idea was to have a mock-up cockpit. They were specifically thinking of training bombers, pilots, and people shooting, you know,
people. Yeah. Practice, you know, without risking the plane.
But what they were asking for was being able to simulate different planes on the same equipment.
Ooh.
So they looked at it and tried to build something analog, and it didn't work. But then one of their team members saw the ENIAC running in 1945, and they thought they'd try building themselves an electronic digital computer.
Hey.
Now, this had a very different mission. Everybody else, you'd load the problem, it would chunk through, and then it would spit out an answer.
Yeah, okay.
Batch mode. This they wanted to be running in real time, interacting with the pilots who were being trained.
Yeah, yeah.
So this meant it had to be able to do a number of things that the other systems could not.
Mm-hmm.
It also meant that they got $3 million for the development contract, which was more money than anybody else had.
Yeah.
Let's be fair. In 1950s money.
Yeah. So yeah. I'd still take it today, but, but yeah.
So a few things they came up with. They had a video display before anybody else did. They had what they called a light pen.
Oh, okay.
Designate some targets. I guess some people on off hours wrote games for it. I ran into one site where they had saved a blackjack game somebody had made.
They were just figuring out the system, and they love blackjack. Yeah.
And other people, if they had, you know, a number of bits that form your word length, and a word is basically, hey, this is a command. I'd argue about what the word lengths were, but everybody else would feed in one bit at a time.
Okay.
Now, that was too slow. So the Whirlwind guys started working on, say, 16 bits at once, parallel bit processing, which is what everybody does nowadays.
Yeah. And 16 bits, I mean, isn't that that's a bigger number than I thought. I thought, don't we start with 8? So, yay, 16
bits. Did I mention that a lot of these systems weren't in the least bit compatible with one another?
We got it working over here. How'd you do that?
We used 8 bits. You did not. One of the things they had trouble with was getting fast enough memory for their primary storage.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Now, there are different levels of storage. Let's not get into that. This is what the computer is using to do its calculations right now. Analogous to RAM.
Yeah, yeah.
RAM being one kind of primary storage and our favorite because it's quick and refreshable and wonderful.
The one that works today. Yeah.
Yes. Well, they did have they tried delay lines. That was going to be too slow. They looked at the Williams tube.
Yeah.
We're storing data on cathode rays.
Okay, yeah.
That wasn't working either. It's too temperamental.
Mm-hmm.
They had a couple of different variants of that, and they eventually settled on magnetic core memory.
Okay, hey.
This is the first magnetic core memory that worked.
All right.
And the first model already had 1,024 bits.
We're on to things here.
Which is pretty good.
Yeah.
Now, the way this works, this does not spin.
Oh,
right. Wow. There's also a magnetic drum, sort of a precursor to spinny disk hard drives.
Okay, yeah.
But we'll talk about that on some other episode.
Right, right. I thought we were ending there for a second.
This one doesn't move. It would address by sending... In fact, I don't know how the addressing system worked. Somehow they got 3 wires to address 1,024 possible places.
Yeah. But good for them.
You'd have a little ring.
Okay.
And you've got a wire wrapped around it.
Okay.
And if you send the current through in one direction, that thing becomes magnetized.
Oh, okay.
North pole facing this way, south pole facing the other way. If you send the current through in the other direction, then the poles are reversed.
Okay.
Reversed magnet. They arbitrarily chose one to represent one and another to represent zero.
Arbitrarily? Okay.
Yes. And then they had a little loop close enough to be inducted.
Uh-huh.
And if it was a zero and they put in this one charge,
uh-huh.
nothing would change. Okay. Nothing gets read out. If it was a one and they put in the charge, the polarity got reversed and that little inductant loop would pick it up.
Aha. Uh-huh.
And then they'd go through some rigmarole to write the one back there because they needed to write the one back there.
So it was destructive, but we'll fix it.
Yeah. Somebody said, oh, it works so much different than our memory today. Not really. A lot of systems. When you read, you have to put the ones back.
I got a one. Oh, wait.
I got one.
Take that back.
What, I get nothing for that? I got one.
Yeah.
Let me say the joke a few more times. It's bound to be funny sooner or later. okay. Smoke them if you got them. I have a way to segue out of this. It was clever. Ah. Anyway, core memory, and even the magnetic drum, which we haven't talked about, and we'll talk about some other day. Stuck around for a long time, a couple of decades, even into the early 80s.
Yeah, yeah.
You could still find systems that were using the core memory. And of course, when they first made it, it was kind of clunky.
Of course.
But over time, they managed to make it smaller and smaller. They never automated the process. These were always hand-built machines.
Oh, wow.
Which is probably why they never got small enough to compete with things that came later.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, there's a whole movement towards miniaturization across the board. You know, these other memory systems like the spinning hard drive, or even like the hard drive I'm using, which is a solid state device.
Hey.
That wasn't even a gleam in an engineer's eye yet.
Yeah.
First, you need semiconductors and integrated circuits, and all of that started with the transistor. Which we'll talk about. Next time. See you then.
Bye.